Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to be diving into a really interesting period, 1757 to 1857, looking at the East India Company and their transformation in India. And we have a pretty good collection of sources. You've given us some historical accounts, some scholarly pieces. And, well, it looks like this is going to be a pretty complex story.
Yeah, it's not just a simple company takes over a nation kind of story.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So to get us started, can you kind of set the scene for us a little bit? What was the East India Company like back in those early days?
Well, you have to kind of imagine like a world that was just, you know, really hungry for spices and fine silks and teas from the East. And the East India Company, which, you know, was chartered way back in 1600, it was essentially just this group of merchants going into this unknown territory trying to get all this these exotic goods.
Okay, so like intrepid entrepreneurs driven by profit. But were they really just merchants, or was there like some hint of imperial ambition even back then?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's where things get a little bit more interesting. You know, the Cambridge Concise Histories, they kind of suggest that, yeah, profit was definitely their main thing. But they also had this sense of, I guess you could say, cultural superiority. You know, they felt like the European way of doing things was better.
Hmm. So even back then, a little bit of that civilizing mission mentality creeping in.
Right.
But how did they go from just having these trading posts to actually, like, governing territories?
Oh.
I mean, was it a gradual process, or was it a series of, like, big dramatic events?
It was kind of both, actually. You know, initially, those company agents that were in India, they were pretty much confined to these, like, coastal enclaves.
Uh-huh.
They were focused on just making trade deals, setting up factories, you know, those trading posts.
Right, right.
But the interesting thing is the Cambridge Concise Histories point out that a lot of these company agents didn't even really bother to learn the local languages or really try to immerse themselves in the Indian culture at all.
So they were operating in kind of a bubble.
Totally, yeah. Just focused on their commercial goals.
Gotcha.
But, you know, that would definitely come back to bite them later on. But for a while, you know, their strategy worked. They established a pretty strong presence in a lot of those key port cities.
Right.
They built these alliances with some of the Indian rulers, and, you know, they started amassing quite a bit of wealth.
Yeah, I mean, they were very successful for a time doing exactly that.
Yeah.
But this kind of cozy arrangement, it couldn't last forever, right?
Right.
I mean, something had to give. So what were some of those turning points that pushed the company towards, you know, taking a more dominant role?
Well, one of the big factors was definitely the competition. You had all these other European powers coming in, especially the French.
Ah, yeah.
And the French East India Company, they had their own ambitions in India. And so they really started to challenge the British for control over some of those key territories.
So the game was on, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely.
It became more than just about securing trade deals.
Yeah.
It was really about power.
Exactly. And so you had this rivalry lead to all these different conflicts, a lot of them involving, you know, alliances with Indian rulers. But the British, they had this like distinct advantage. They had a really well-organized military force, and they had this growing sense of, you know, their own imperial destiny.
Right, right. This is where figures like Robert Clive start to come into the picture, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, he was really instrumental in a lot of the company's military victories.
He was. You know, a lot of people see Clive's victory at the Battle of Plassey in 1757 as a real turning point because it gave the company control over Bengal, which was this like incredibly wealthy and populous region. And that was a, you know, a huge shift in that power dynamic.
Yeah. So Plassey was a real game changer. They went from traders to, you know, really becoming rulers, at least in Bengal.
Yeah. And that victory just like emboldened them. They realized, you know, military power, this could be used not just to protect their trade, but to expand their territory. And that's exactly what they did.
Right.
Over that next century, they just kept expanding, taking over big chunks of India.
Wow. What a rapid transformation. But I can imagine this transition from, you know, merchants to rulers, that wasn't easy, right?
Oh, definitely not.
I mean, how do they actually govern these new territories they were acquiring?
Yeah.
Do they try to, like, impose British laws and customs on everyone?
Well, that's a really good question. And it's actually, that's where we're going to see how their lack of cultural understanding from the early days starts to create a bunch of problems.
Right.
But we'll dive into all of that in the next part of our deep dive.
Okay, so we've got the East India Company, and they've, you know, they've gotten a taste of power now. They've secured Bengal, and their ambitions are definitely growing. But now they've got to figure out how to actually govern this huge, complex region. What was their approach like? Did they come in and say, all right, everybody, we're doing things the British way now? Or was it more kind of nuanced than that.
Well, it's really interesting because their approach was, well, I guess you could say pragmatic, maybe even a little bit haphazard at first. I mean, these guys weren't trained administrators, right? They were businessmen.
Right.
So they had to adapt. And a lot of times that meant, you know, incorporating existing Indian systems into their own.
So not a complete, like, you know, rip it all out and start over. More like layering their control on top of what was already there.
Yeah, exactly. And Kulke and Rothermond, in A History of India, they talk about how the company, you know, they kept a lot of those pre-existing administrative units, like the Ahara, which were basically districts. Huh. And they even kept a lot of the local officials, the Amatya, on board.
Interesting.
I mean, it helped maintain some sense of continuity. And honestly, it just made their jobs a lot easier.
Yeah. Smart move. All right. Less disruption. Probably less resistance, too. Mm-hmm. But this whole kind of, you know, fusion of British and Indian systems, I mean, that couldn't have been without its tensions, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you had this clash of cultures, legal traditions, even economic philosophies. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, those early company agents, they weren't exactly known for being, you know, culturally sensitive.
Right, right.
So, yeah, you start to see these cracks appear.
Okay. So is this when we start seeing the rise of figures like Tipu Sultan, you know, actively resisting the company's expansion?
Yeah, Tipu Sultan's a great example of how the company's kind of growing dominance really started to trigger resistance. He was the ruler of Mysore in southern India, known for being, you know, a brilliant military leader.
Uh-huh.
And he really saw the company as this major threat to Indian sovereignty.
I mean, he didn't just sit back and watch them take over.
Oh, no. He fought back hard.
Yeah.
Tipu Sultan, he modernized his army. He even used rockets, which was pretty cutting edge for the time.
Why?
And he formed all these alliances to try to counter the company's forces. He really understood the threat they posed, you know, not just militarily, but culturally, too.
Yeah. It's almost like a Shakespearean kind of story, you know, this
yeah.
valiant ruler battling against this rising empire. It makes you wonder, like, what if others had followed his lead? Could they have actually stopped the company's expansion?
That's one of the big what ifs in history. You know, while Tipu Sultan, he put up an amazing fight, ultimately, he was defeated.
Right.
The company, I mean, they had so many resources and they were so good at making strategic alliances that, you know, they were often able to overcome these kinds of challenges.
So they just kept expanding their territory. But they're also, you know, they're transforming India's economy at the same time, right? I mean,
yeah.
They weren't just interested in governing. They were in it for the profit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is really where, you know, you start to see that darker side of their rule. They put all these policies in place that were specifically designed to extract wealth from India, often at the expense of local industries. You know, the indigo trade, for example, became this huge source of revenue for the company. But it relied on basically forced labor. And it really drove a lot of Indian farmers into poverty.
So it's that classic colonial model,
mm-hmm.
right? You exploit the resources, you create this system that benefits the colonizer, while at the same time, it's impoverishing the people who are being colonized.
Exactly. And this economic drain, I mean, it just fueled more and more resentment. And then on top of that, you had the introduction of Western education, which, you know, on the surface, it was supposed to create a class of Indians that could help the company administer things, you know, basically clerks and translators. But like you said earlier, it also exposed them to all these ideas about democracy, individual rights, even revolution.
Right.
It's kind of ironic when you think about it.
It is, yeah. They're basically laying the groundwork for their own eventual demise.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
But before we get to that, I am curious about, like, the social and cultural impact of the company's rule. How did they influence Indian society beyond just the economy? So we've seen how the East India Company went from, you know, traders looking for spices and silks to, well, rulers with a whole lot of power. But as their empire grew, so did the problems. So what were some of the big social and cultural changes that happened during their time in India?
Well, you got to remember that India in like the 18th and 19th centuries, it was this incredibly diverse place. So many different cultures, religions, social structures, and the company's arrival and then all their policies, it really had this ripple effect, you know?
Right. So it wasn't just about like taking resources. It was about reshaping Indian society, like from the ground up.
Yeah, exactly. Take their whole thing with English education. I mean, at first it was supposed to be about creating this class of Indians who could help them run things, you know, like clerks and translators.
Yeah.
But as we said before, it also meant exposing them to these Western ideas about democracy and individual rights, even revolution.
So it's like they accidentally gave them the tools to like challenge their rule later on.
Right. This really interesting case of unintended consequences. And then you also had the spread of Christianity, although it wasn't on a huge scale. You had these missionaries often coming in with the company officials trying to convert people. They saw it as part of their, you know, civilizing mission.
Which I imagine created even more tension, right? I mean, when you start challenging people's deeply held religious beliefs, they're not going to be too happy about it.
Absolutely. And you can see this reflected in the sources you provided. The Cambridge Concise Histories, for example, they talk about how there was this growing anxiety among certain groups in Indian society. They were worried about, you know, losing their traditional values and having this Western culture imposed on them.
So this simmering discontent, this clash of cultures, was that one of the main things that led to the Sepoy Mutiny in 1857?
Definitely. The mutiny wasn't just some random military uprising. It was the culmination of all these different grievances that had been building up for years. The whole controversy with the rifle cartridges, you know, the rumors that they were greased with animal fat, that was just the spark. The real fuel was this deep resentment against the company's rule, their economic policies, and all their social and cultural interventions.
And the mutiny, even though it was brutally crushed, it became this symbol of resistance, right? And ultimately, it kind of sealed the company's fate.
Exactly. The British government, they saw how unstable things were becoming, and they realized they needed to step in. So in 1858, they dissolved the East India Company and took direct control over India. And that's how the British Raj began.
So in a way, the company's own actions, their greed, their lack of cultural awareness, it all kind of backfired on them.
It's a good reminder that empires built on exploitation and trying to force your culture on other people, well, they're not going to last forever. It's a powerful lesson, for sure. The East India Company story is definitely a cautionary tale, but it's also a testament to the resilience of Indian society. Even though they faced all these incredible challenges, they held on to their cultural identity, and ultimately, they played a huge role in shaping their own destiny.
This deep dive has been amazing. We've traced the East India Company's rise and fall, and we've really gotten into all those complex layers of, you know, trade, conquest, and this clash of cultures.
Yeah.
It's a story that still matters today. It reminds us of the legacies of colonialism and how important it is to understand the past so we can, you know, make sense of the present.
And for everyone listening, remember, history isn't just about memorizing dates and battles. It's about understanding the choices people made, the ideas that shaped their world, and the consequences that rippled through time to create the world we live in today. So keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.